Hello, folks, and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Features. I'm your host, Tom Majeure, and I'm at Camp Asabo in Grayling, Michigan. And the topic we're going to talk about today is snowy owls and migration. My guest today is Dr. Gordon Atkins. Welcome, Dr. Atkins.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You have kind of a nickname here at camp. What do they call you?
I'm best known as the Nature Guy.
Nature Guy. And you actually do a few videos to share the nature, and and Strong Tower Radio, we're going to try to get those on our website.
Yes, we do a weekly broadcast on some topic in nature.
Absolutely. Let's start with a word of prayer. Our Father in Heaven, it's such a blessing to look at your nature, and the deeper we look, and if we use the perspective of a creation and God environment, it even gives us more wonder to our Creator. Lord, be with us as we explore this exciting topic, that the more we learn, the more we will love nature and we will love you. In Jesus' name, amen. Dr. Atkins, some of those who come to Camp Asabo here in Grayling, a Christian youth camp all year round with multiple programs, not only for youth, but whole families, and ways to get refreshed, marriage retreats, just a whole variety of great programs here.
Yes, we have a variety of them, and I'm in charge of the nature portion of those. And so summer camp is a big time. And also through the school year, we run an outdoor education program for all of our schools across Michigan.
Now, at this campground that has on-site housing, like you said, there's a youth summer camp program with waterfront activities and nature and high adventure, which is climbing and doing a variety of things and crafts. And we feature that each year, and we have do that again this year, probably about the last 5 years. But there's a nature center. Why is there a nature center at Camp Asabo?
Well, I like to say that nature is the art of God.
The art of God.
And by studying the artist's work, we learn a little bit more about him. And so a combination of reading the scriptures and studying his handiwork give us, I think, a better picture, a total picture.
And here at Camp Asabo, they have a real commitment to nature and the study of it.
Yes, I work here full-time, and we have a great nature center that I inherited and that we continue to develop and develop programs both on and off camp.
Now, do nature, do camps, that we're talking about a Seventh-day Adventist camp, but how prevalent are nature centers on camps and on Seventh-day Adventists? I did study on this, there's about 50 Seventh-day Adventist camps across the United States. What percentage of them have a formal nature center?
Most of them have some sort of a nature center. It may be just a single room in a building somewhere, or maybe even a basement. But there's always that desire to have some representation of God's nature as part of the programming. And of course, most of the camps are out in nature. So just being there is part of that experience. Learning about it is the second part. And we're very fortunate to have a very lovely nature center that allows us to do that in a big way.
Now tell our listeners, how big is this nature center, and what exhibits are in this nature center?
Well, it's three stories, and in the nature center we have, I'll start in the lower level, we actually have a chemistry lab so that we can do microscopy and chemistry as it relates to nature. It's maybe the only chemistry lab that also has snowshoes.
Okay.
Really multi-purpose.
And the purpose of that lab is more towards an outdoor education program?
We use it in outdoor ed. We also teach some classes at summer camp. So we'll teach a chemistry class every other year, alternate that with a microscopic life class.
Okay. And just go on a little bit of a tangent there. What is outdoor education?
So outdoor ed is a three-day experience that we've designed for fifth and sixth graders, but some of the smaller multi-grade classrooms, we get more than fifth or sixth graders. And each season we offer a different version, fall and winter, spring, where we highlight some of the really cool stuff that happens at Camp Isabel during those seasons. And they're just immersed in learning outside as much as we can. Of course, the bad weather in winter might chase us in some, but it's learning firsthand about some of the nature that God has created.
And this is integrated with the Seventh-day Adventist education system here in Michigan.
Correct. All of our schools send their fifth and sixth graders. We break them up. We never like to have more than 15 at a time if we can, because obviously a big group outside really going to see nothing. So we divide up into small groups and do that throughout the year.
So this is a great information. In that building we talked about in the basement, you have live reptiles and other fish.
Yes. In addition to the lab, we have a live room. We have a bunch of displays on sort of ecology, the different types of life zones that exist beyond just what we have here at Camp Isabel. We have a lot of mounts of birds and mammals that we have permit for to have. And we're currently working on a walk through the Creation Week as an exhibit. And that's a big undertaking, and it's frustratingly slow sometimes because the programs are most important, but then when we can work on infrastructure, that's cool as well.
So listeners, you get an idea that camp, and can people come and visit if you're not a camper? Is there some arrangements that can be made that the public can come and see these?
Yes, we've recently opened up the boardwalk, which goes around Lake Schellenbarger, which is on our property. We actually call it the Lakeside Trail. Most of it is boardwalk, but we've now connected that all the way around the lakeshore, so we call it the Lakeshore Trail. And visitors can come and
sign in.
Check in at the office. There's a registration that actually they'll give you a card that'll last for the year, so you just have to come sign in and go walking whenever you want.
What a privilege. And where is this camp?
Camp Isabel is in Grayling, Michigan, and it's just off of Highway 72, just a little bit east of Grayling.
Very good. Well, what we're here to talk about is the migration. We're talking about the snowy owls in particular, and just put our toe into the subject of migration. This is kind of like a premiere, a debut of a program. Migration, how often does migration take place in Michigan?
Well,
does migration, is it the same all over the world?
No, it's different. It depends on the species. It depends on where you are in the season. Migration can happen often. And so, yeah, we need to talk a little bit about the basics of migration.
So migration isn't migration?
No. Okay. There's several different kinds of migration, and there's nuances as you study each species and how they do it. The mechanism of finding their way, that's another whole topic called navigation, which we'll deal with in future episodes.
You know, it's interesting. There's two types of migrations that I think many people can relate to. One is the monarch migration that you see in the fall, and in this area, it seems like it's around Labor Day weekend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what got many people thinking about it was the Canadian goose population, Canada goose population, and migration, and it was almost getting at a low dangerous level, and conservation efforts took place, and I think the public became aware of migration maybe through that.
Sure, and just the spectacle of, you know, one day you're outside doing whatever you're doing, and that big flock of noisy whatever goes over, you can't help but notice migration.
Or are they congregating at a pond near you?
Yeah, have they landed in your front yard?
That's right.
So, yeah, there's different kinds of migration, and this might be a good time to talk about some of the broad categories of migration. So what we usually think of migration is what scientists will call long-distance migration, where an animal or insect, a fish, lots of organisms do this, but where there's a need to move from one area to another to survive. And so usually one of the destinations is a great nesting, or if it's fish, a spawning location, an area to have enough resources to reproduce. But that area is often not habitable all year long. And so they've got to go to another place to find food to make it through the rest of the year and then come back to this ideal breeding area. So it's this, 'cause birds, fish, animals, they can't survive in every condition. Some are more generalist than others, but they have to move in order to be able to fulfill their annual cycles. Then there is what we call short distance migrants, where like a pine warbler might migrate from the top of a mountain in the summer down to the valley for the winter and back up.
So that's a mile or two.
It may only be a mile or two.
Where the long distance, there's some champions of long distance, but what is the minimum threshold for a long term?
I don't know there's an exact cutoff, but we're talking about hundreds and thousands of miles as opposed to, you know, a few miles. And then the third broad category of migration is what we call a partial migrant. And that is a species that some may migrate and leave and others may stay. And probably in Michigan, robins and blue jays fit that category. Many of them do migrate to somewhere south where there's more food, but some will stay year-round. And so you may notice subtle differences in the numbers of robins in your yard, more in the summer, if you're lucky, some in the winter, but a lot of them will be gone. So we refer to those as partial migrants.
What about the migration of the monarch butterflies, which we all love the monarchs? We have learned that it's not the same butterfly that comes, that goes, and then there's legs. Is that, are you getting to that?
Well, this would certainly be an example of long distance migration, because they migrate from, well, at least our monarchs here in Michigan are going to go to Mexico. So that definitely is a long distance. And there it's very interesting. We'll have a couple of episodes on the monarch itself, because it's not the same monarch that left here that comes back here. And so that's a really interesting story we'll deal with later.
Absolutely. Well, listeners, you're listening to Strong Tower Radio feature, and we're talking about migration. This is a debut of programs that we're really excited about doing with Dr. Atkins. We're going to look at migrations in the fall and migration in the spring, and we're going to be defining and learning a lot. We've put together a schedule, and it's pretty exciting, Dr. Atkins. Thank you so much for being here and being a part of this program.
It's a pleasure.
Let's continue on migration.
Okay, so if we're going to talk about owls today particularly, then we need to realize that migration isn't always north and south, although often it is. And depending on where we are, so here we are in Michigan, we usually think of ourselves as north. Compared to other places, we are, but compared to places north of us, we're south.
And we're only about halfway to the pole.
Exactly. We're really right in between. So there are species that breed in Michigan that will migrate south because the conditions are not right. And the main reason there, of course, is all the insect-eating birds can't find anything in the winter. But Michigan's a great place to find insects and have your nest and raise your young. So they come here to breed, and then they depart when there's no food available. But there are other birds that live further north from us that then travel south to find more food, and south to them is Michigan. So they're, I like to tell the kids in outdoor ed that they're flying to warm, balmy Michigan for the winter, because compared to where they were, that is true. So snowy owls in particular, they breed on the tundra. So that's north of all the conifer forests of the most of the Canadian provinces, and they're further north on that tundra, which is where they nest. They nest on the ground, and their main food source are lemmings, which are usually plentiful up there.
Now, I want to nail down this geography. Are we talking Arctic Circle? Are we talking about as far north as Alaska? Give us something that we can grab our minds on this.
Well, a lot of it is above the Arctic Circle. Unfortunately, the Arctic Circle and the North American continent are kind of at odds with each other. So it's a little further south on the east part. When you go further west in North America, you've got to go further north to get to tundra. So it kind of cuts across at an angle. But roughly the Arctic Circle, above the tree line. And so that's parts of, you know, the northern half of Alaska, much of the Yukon and Northwest Territories, and even into northern Quebec and Labrador. All of those areas would be above the tree line.
Well, I'm wondering, Dr. Atkins, if somebody wanted to do a quick search of the habitat for that, what would be one way, or for the snowy owls, what would they look for?
In terms of looking for the habitat?
Yeah.
A fun way is to get on Google Earth and just go, and you can just see the color change where the trees end, and the tundra itself is pretty visible. But if you Googled tundra in North America, you get a clear map of where that is. So why do the owls migrate from there? Well, there are lemmings year round. They don't curl up and die like an insect might, but they are under deeper snow. Although the tundra doesn't get a whole lot of snow. We think of the north as snow, but it's really cold. They certainly do get snow, and it does pile up. There are lemmings around, and interestingly, most years, adult snowy owls can find and capture those. The problem with winter up there is it's dark all the time. So owls, of course, are a group of birds that can use their sense of hearing very well. And they're able to, they also have very sensitive eyes, but when it's really dark, you're dependent on sound. And so what happens is the younger birds that have maybe were chicks during the summer and have grown up and are now off on their own, they can't find their own food as well in the dark. And so younger snowy owls will tend to migrate to places where there's enough daylight to hunt in the daytime.
What is the definition of a young owl?
That would be 8 or 9 months. By time they have fledged and are flying off on their own, then they're finding food on their own.
So we're not seeing the whole family coming if they come this far south?
Usually it's just the young ones. The adults will stay there. And they have their own territories. They'll tend to wander. They won't necessarily nest in exactly the same spot because it depends on the populations of lemmings, which we know rise and fall.
But we don't have lemmings in Michigan, do we?
We don't. So they depend then on meadow voles and mice and other small rodents that are sort of fill a similar niche, but here in our fields. You tend not to see the snowy owls in forested areas. So we don't really get any at Camp Isabel because we're in a pine forest here. But if you go to any of the open areas, you have a chance of seeing a snowy owl. And the best place here in Michigan, in my opinion, is Rudyard, Michigan, which is in the UP. So if you just cross the Mackinac Bridge, you're about 20 minutes further north on 75, you come to the little town of Rudyard. There's a little turnoff. And if you pull off and pull into town, you'll see a sign, the Snowy Owl Capital. Because the farming area there has been a really good spot for snowy owls traditionally and again this year. And the theory kind of is that you can imagine if you're looking at the geography, if looking at a map, you were born and raised in the tundra. You're going south to find a place to find food in the daylight. The first opening after traveling over hundreds of miles of pine forest is Rudyard. And if you miss that one, then further south at Gaylord and then further south into lower Michigan where there are a lot of fields. So they need that open field to find their food source. And so why some years we have a lot and other years we don't is still being studied, but there are certainly several indications. One of them basically is the population of lemmings themselves. If there are a lot of lemmings, if they're crawling all over the place.
And you can't miss it even in the dark.
If you can't miss them even in the dark, then they're going to be more likely to stay. If the lemmings are somewhat reduced from that, then the poorer hunters, the young ones, may decide to fly south to find a better situation where they can catch their food. And in really bad years, when the lemming population has crashed and there's nothing even for the adults, then you will get adults flying south. And so when they all fly south, that's what we often refer to as an eruption.
That's the word,
yes. In migration, we refer to that where there's the sudden surge of migration to a particular area. And this season, this winter, has been somewhat of an eruption year. I was up at Rudyard a week and a half ago, and I think we saw 11 snowy owls in just half an hour. We just kind of did a little loop through the main area. We couldn't stay long. We were on another longer trip. But I think someone else had just reported recently over 20 of them in that area in about an hour's effort of looking. So they're pretty thick up there. Now, they've also, some have moved further south. And so there are locations across Michigan now that are seeing them, and they've gone further south than Michigan. In fact, there's a famous one right now who decided to spend the winter in Southern California.
Oh,
just south of LA.
Do you think he'll ever go back?
I am pretty sure he will after being there for a few months, especially when the heat turns on. So these birds will go as far as they need to go until they can find a food source.
Are you guaranteed to see something Rudyard every year, at least one or a few?
There seem to always be one or two, and they seem, in my experience, to be the same ones. They have their favorite poll. They have their certain coloration. Now, it turns out not all snowy owls are pure white. That's just the adult male. Shades of brown and gray added in, and you can tell the age of an adult. 1, 2, 3, and 4 is finally the adult age. So, and then there's 4 years of plumage of a female snowy owl. Hopefully you can figure them all out, but it's all just a few extra spots here and there. So you can follow a bird over several seasons and know it's the same one.
Very good. Is there anything more about snowy owls that we should talk about before we continue on migration?
Well, there's a lot more we could talk about. I've got a couple of videos on that website you were referring to. I think one of the things that is really neat about the snowy owl is if you get to see one, you can see them in the day. A lot of owls are only active at night, but these guys active in the morning and evening. So in the winter, no leaves on the trees, owls sitting around. It's a great way to watch an owl. And a lot of the nature centers will have little postings of the local where things are. There's online resources where you can look up. In fact, I'm pretty sure that if you just typed in snowy owl in Michigan, you'd get some reports. There is a database called eBird, which we'll talk about at another time, that is sort of a citizen science reporting, so that every bird that gets seen, that gets recorded, you can have access to. And so there's probably an eBird report near you about a snowy owl here in Michigan this year.
How long could we, our listeners, go out and look for this snowy owl and have a good probability of finding? How long does this migration last?
They usually start showing up the end of December and January, and they certainly have. And this will continue for sure through the month of February. And some linger on in March, and I've even seen one in the 1st of April. Usually they're densest right about now, this month of February.
What other thoughts do you want to give our listeners about migration in their last 3 minutes of the program?
Sure. Well, it turns out migration, you know, again, we've mentioned every species is a little different. But for the birds, there are sort of four flyways that they use during migration. Now, a flyway is just a sort of a broad sense of where the birds are tracking. So they're not, I guess, another way of saying is you've put a radar up and looked across all North America, not all places are equal. Some places you'll see migrating birds and others you won't see nearly as many. So the flyways in North America are the Atlantic flyway, of course, where they're following the Atlantic coast. The flip side is the Pacific flyway, following the Pacific coast primarily. Then there's the Mississippi flyway, which really comes down Hudson Bay, James Bay, cuts across Ontario to the Great Lakes, and then follows the Mississippi Valley all the way down to the Gulf.
Sounds like water is usually involved.
Yes, major waterways are good landmarks. So at least for those birds that follow visual patterns, then that works. The remaining one is sort of the central flyway, which is through the Great Plains, right down the middle. And that's kind of really following the eastern edge of the Rockies, as it were. So elevation and water between those two, it kind of defines in broad strokes where birds are going.
Now, there are navigational methods. We can't cover them all, but to name is there four different navigations?
There's five or six, really, that they use. Some birds prefer one over the other, and most birds use a combination. Some follow the sun compass. Some follow the star compass, like sailors have been doing for a long time. Light from the moon can be used for migration for some species. The magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field, and it turns out that birds actually have compasses built into their system, so we'll talk about that sometime. Some, of course, use landmarks. Some will even use the sense of smell. But birds are thought to be poor at detecting sense of smell because it only works for 60 miles. But that's better than my sense of smell.
So yeah, that's right.
Find your way home from 60 miles away with your eyes closed and just sniffing the air. And then one of the more recent ones, which is really interesting, is that they follow infrasound, which are vibrations below what we can hear. So the rumblings of the earth, tectonic plates, gurgling under volcanoes, all that kind of stuff, underwater rivers, are sounds that the birds can pick up, and they use that to find their way as well.
Well, Dr. Atkins, the nature guy, we have just literally scratched the surface.
Mm-hmm.
We've laid out migrations for the spring and for the fall. So listeners, stay tuned. We do have a plan, and this will be just one of the many features that we have here on Strong Tower Radio Feature. Stay tuned. I'm Tom Majeur with Dr. Gordon Atkins, reporting from Grayling, Michigan, for the program Strong Tower Radio Features. Stay tuned. We'll see you next time. Bye now.